Indigenous Resistance. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. What would be maybe at the top of your list of things that must be done and that can be done, solutions?
I think the first question is always land back. That seems unimaginable to a lot of people, but there's been land reform throughout various histories in Latin America. Not all of it has been perfect, but the United States hasn't undergone land reform whatsoever. That is the primary concern of a lot of indigenous people because that's where our economies are tied. That's where all of the social issues that we face today are always tied to the land. That, before anything else, has to come first.
And is there any movement in that direction?
Absolutely. There's urban, you know, in the city that I live, there was the Stop the Roof Depot demolition where the indigenous dominant neighborhood of East Phillips occupied a site that was supposed to be demolished by the city. They stopped the demolition, which would have put more toxins into the atmosphere, and they're trying to reclaim that site for not only the indigenous people who live in that community, but also for the non-indigenous people, to reclaim it as a site for farming, sustainable farming, agriculture, and sort of local businesses. There's also still the ongoing efforts to reclaim the Black Hills, and I think we're going to see some more action around that in the coming years. It's an outstanding land claim, and it's not going away anytime soon.
Where do you stand on this whole issue of reform versus radical change? Mm-hmm. You know, do you believe in incremental improvements, or do you feel that, you know, the times demand radical substantive change?
I don't think it's an either or. I think it's both, because there are certain things that can make the quality of life of people here in this country, in this planet, like much more livable through just minor reforms. And that can be a way to show, like, you know, when we were talking earlier about winning these victories, like if you change a mascot, abolish the Washington football team mascot, if you changed the mascot for the Cleveland Indians, those are huge shifts, but it's also like you're building a movement, and that raises the psychological, it has a psychological effect. So when you make these minor reforms, it shows that things are achievable and winnable. But even when you lose those minor reforms, you still have, hopefully, an organization, a network of people who you know will be trying to build for something bigger and better. The current landscape is issue-based. We're taught to be issue-based activists, issue-based focused, and not look at broader picture, you know? And so I think both are possible, to look at these issue-based and understand that these are local struggles, like whether it's a pipeline. We didn't stop the Dakota Access Pipeline, but nonetheless, it was a win. It was part of a longer struggle to radically transform our carbon economy. But you also have to be fighting for alternatives that don't just simply, oh, we're going to replace this with a green economy. That's still going to require the same kind of colonial relationship to now, instead of extracting oil, we're going to extract lithium from your lands, right? We do need those materials to transition, but it has to be negotiated and it has to be on the terms of the people who are most impacted. That's the reform side. The radical side, they always say the horizon of struggle. Why do they say the horizon of struggle? Because as you approach the horizon, it keeps going further and further and further into the distance. If you don't have that dialectical thinking about the future and how history actually works, you might arrive somewhere and think that that's an okay place to be, but that's not reflective of human nature. Human nature is constantly evolving. Human culture is constantly evolving. There are always things, inequities within ourselves, our relationships to each other, as well as the land that need to be resolved. However, that transformation, when they say revolution, it's not an instantaneous thing. It's something that unfolds over generations.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has in very bold terms talked about the climate crisis we're facing, using phrases like time is running out, the clock is ticking, etc. What are your views on the climate crisis, and can this system be nimble enough to address it in a way that will not, you know, cause widespread chaos, which is looming?
I mean, it's a good question. I'm not a sage in terms of I can't predict the future, but I can tell you what's happening now. We are experiencing the effects of carbon that was put into the atmosphere generations ago. So if we think about what we're putting in today, how bad the changes in the weather have happened just in our current moment, think about we're exponentially greater than what was put out, generations ago. So if we're thinking about it in those terms, it paints a very bleak picture, right? But I also think that there are trends that I think are important. But if we look globally, we look at, even the COP meetings, it's usually dominated by the North Atlantic nations or, the NATO nations, whatever you want to call it. And they all followed a path of development that required immense amount of carbon input that the rest of the world is paying for. So therefore, if the rest of the world is paying for that amount of carbon that these nations, these so-called first world nations, produced and emitted to build their societies at the expense not just of, the people that they colonized, but also the future generations, then those nations also owe in perpetuity reparations to the people who are also trying to develop, because they can't develop along the same trajectory using and emitting the same carbon, right? India is now the most populous country in the world, and it's building coal-fired power plant after coal-fired power plant. And you see in the New York Times, you see in all these Western media sources talking about the immense amount of pollution that's going to be required. This isn't India's problem. This is a first world problem, because the first world colonized the atmosphere with their carbon pollution so that they could develop along the same lines. And now they're saying, no, the third world can't develop that same way. It's not to say that there are alternatives that don't exist. There are, but we also have to remove the sort of restrictions on technology transfers for green, sustainable energy, right? And a lot of the patents most of them are held by China, but a lot of them are held by the United States. And so when we talk about climate change, we're talking about a global project. In the context of the United States and Canada, indigenous-led movements, a report from 2021 found that was authored by Indigenous Environmental Network, that indigenous-led movements in Canada and the United States against carbon infrastructure and extraction, as well as greenhouse gas emission, accounted for challenging a quarter of emissions from both Canada and the United States. Indigenous-led movements essentially are challenging a quarter of carbon emissions from Canada and the United States. That's a huge amount, especially given the fact that we're around 1%, 2% of the population. It's higher in Canada, but it shows you the effectiveness of those kinds of movements and promoting a carbon-free future. However, we live in a country that is constantly at war, that is pushing a war in Ukraine so that essentially it can strong arm rob Russia from its gas and energy contracts with Europe. But that gas and that energy has to come from somewhere. So what did Biden do in the approval of the Willow Project? He said, this is for national security, because we need to supply, we have to make up the deficit for Russian oil going to Europe, because they are no longer able to buy gas as cheaply, right? And we saw this. So not only do these movements have to be looking at this broader sort of critique of the environment and the pollution and third world development, but they also have to be anti-imperialist and opposing these wars and understanding that these resource wars and these energy wars disproportionately impact marginalized communities.
Talk about daily life on the res. What's it like?
Well, so I've only lived on the res for maybe 2 or 3 years consecutively in my life. I didn't grow up there. I visited it quite a bit, but I can't speak to that experience. However, I would just say that I'll just give you some examples. During this last winter storm, which was really bad, all of the reservation roads were plowed because the priority was around public safety. As soon as you got to the state line, the governor of South Dakota, Kristi Noem, and the Department of Transportation didn't plow the roads. You had people in Rosebud, South Dakota, burning clothes because their roads weren't plowed by the state for almost 5 days. People died. the life expectancy of American Indian people during following the COVID-19 pandemic, which we're still sort of in, and we are in some ways, but it dropped by, I think it was 6.9 years, which is massive. If we saw this happen in a different country, to a different demographic, there would be some sort of NGO going in advocating for the overthrow of the government or saying that it's some sort of genocide. But it's been relatively silent. And the studies that have come out about this decline in life expectancy, which is much worse for Native American males than it is for women or people identified as women, this does account for COVID death and comorbidities, but the pattern is still continuing. And it's because, I believe, and we're seeing this across other demographics, a declining standard of living in the United States. And so that disproportionately impacts the people who are at the bottom, which includes indigenous people. So I want to point out those two examples, because also Native people had some of the highest rates of vaccination, especially on the reservations. So there was an understanding, even though the reservations are often seen as these kind of rural, isolated pockets of poverty, life is prioritized for the collective good when it can be, when the resources are there to plow roads and to administer vaccines. But we are underfunded, not just on reservations, but across the board. And that's a direct result of colonialism. And we have not had a single administration who has adequately addressed this. And the question is now, do we keep depending on the federal government and keep going to the federal government? The Pope has repudiated the doctrine of discovery, but the United States still acts like a colonial power. That's the question that we have to ask ourselves. Is this a system that's worth sustaining? Because it's not only killing us at high rates, it's now killing everyday Americans at high rates.
And what about neoliberalism, which was introduced in the late 70s, early 80s? Has that had a particular impact on Native peoples?
So it has. I mean, I don't want to glorify the past Bureau of Indian Affairs, but it used to be centralized. It used to be a central system, for better or worse, but every tribe was guaranteed a similar access or equitable access to healthcare, for example, or other kind of services, education, which we know resulted in boarding schools and things like that. But following Nixon's declaration of self-determination, that basically turned tribes into nonprofits who were competing for an allocated pool of money through the federal system. And much like nonprofits compete for funding for grants and things like that, now their healthcare systems, their clinics, their domestic violence shelters, their police departments, their hospitals, their roads, everything is now in a competition with other tribes. That's the market correcting itself according to neoliberalism. It didn't necessarily privatize the assets of tribes, but it turned them into entities that were competing with other tribes instead of equitably reallocating resources. Now, the question, though, is less about this tribal system that was put into place with self-determination, and more about the fact that the United States has consistently used the trust funds that it has acquired through treaties to not only dispossess tribes by paying for these boarding schools that Native children were sent to. This wasn't coming out of taxpayers' dollars. This was coming from land ceded. This was a contractual negotiation by tribes with the federal government. Now we're seeing that happen with healthcare, and now with under Democratic controlled Congresses and whatever, they still act as if they're giving us a handout. And it says, no, this is a treaty obligation. You made these treaties. They're newer. They're younger than the U.S. Constitution. So you're obligated to uphold them. But instead, they're treating them as like, oh, here's a grant that you can apply for. And maybe you want to build a domestic violence shelter. Or, we have all these law enforcement grants that you can get. It's easier to build a juvenile detention facility than it is to build a domestic violence shelter. The last I checked, there were about maybe two domestic violence shelters on Indian reservations that were tribally run. That's not very many, considering murdered missing Indigenous women, considering the crisis of violence against women and families on reservations, but also the inadequacy of schools. So the priority has followed, you know, larger national trends in taking what should be for the betterment of social welfare through education, you know, adequate health care, access to healthy foods, you know, just standards, good quality standards of living are now being allocated. The solution is, oh, we just need more policing. We need more law enforcement. Because in the United States, under neoliberalism, you only have a hammer and everything looks like a nail. So everything is solvable by increasing police funding, increasing incarceration.
You've taught and lived in New Mexico and now you're in Minnesota. Can you compare the two?
Spice. One has it, the other one lacks it.
but both have large indigenous populations.
Yes and no. I would say that the indigenous population of New Mexico is much more visible and larger. And I would actually say that the relationships, I mean, for better or worse, you know, with between the state and the tribes is better in New Mexico than it is in Minnesota. Because you have to remember, Minnesota was founded and sort of consolidated itself with the U.S. Dakota War. It was a genocide and expulsion of Dakota people from their homelands in Minnesota, and they've never been allowed to return. So, and also Winnebago, or excuse me, Ho-Chunk people as well. Not to say that New Mexico doesn't have its own faults, but that's the mentality of Minnesota. You have, just like in New Mexico, things named after conquistadors. In Minnesota, you have things named after people like Sibley or Ramsey or Hennepin, people who were foundational to not only the dispossession of Dakota people and Ojibwe people, but also the architects of Dakota genocide and expulsion, being named after things. It's like, imagine the Soviets didn't liberate Germany. What would the Nazi regime look like? It would be adoration for the architects of genocide and the Holocaust. That's what Minnesota is. And it's proud of its heritage, which is extremely disconcerting, especially given the fact that it tends to be a liberal, or at least it fashions itself as a liberal, kind of left-leaning state. But it has this very intense form of settler colonialism that you just don't experience in a place like New Mexico. And I'll give you one example. It's the university I work at. This last semester, there was a report issued called the Truth Report, which was written by three graduate students, Anne Gary Gola, Adriana Goodwin, and Misty Blue. And they worked with different scholars from the various tribes that are still remaining within the state. I think there's 13 fellows. And they wrote a report that documented how when the university was founded, it used the funds that it made from the seizures of mostly Dakota land and put it into its permanent university fund. That permanent university fund became the starting capital, not just for the University of Minnesota, but it became the starting capital for the state of Minnesota, because the people who were sitting on the original Board of Regents were the governor, Alexander Ramsey, and many of the architects of the Dakota genocide. So they used the university as a sort of pot of money. And they've tracked this fund not only went to university activities for the betterment, you know, as a land grant institution, for the betterment of, you know, the state of Minnesota, but it was also, that money was used, it was bonded out to municipalities to build a road, to build a bridge, to improve the quality of life of the settler population there. And so this money, which is blood money, essentially, the university has been sitting on this and has now cut my department. They've cut our budgets. They're squeezing our resources. We're the oldest American Indian Studies department in the country. Founded in 1969, we've had a Dakota language program and Ojibwe language program going back to like the early 60s, maybe even earlier than that. And those are the Dakota language program is actually hit by these budget cuts. This is the mentality. Like, even in light of this very damning report, which made headlines in NBC News that said that the University of Minnesota profited from genocide, they still have the audacity to cut the very programs that keep Native students, not only within the university system, but in the state itself. you know, they may say very nice things. You know, we might have like people appointed representatives, natives in, you know, this position or that position. But in actual practice, that mentality, that settler mentality still exists, that they don't owe us a penny. I joked with my department. I said, we should just take a bond out from this permanent university fund and not pay it back. But you can't do that. That's illegal. But that's the mentality. And I think a state like Minnesota needs to take a hard look at itself and understand that it's not just the land that it took, but it took generations of wealth away from Native people, especially Dakota people who I'm descendant from, who live in some of the poorest counties in places like, you know, Crow Creek or, you know, elsewhere. That those are the original people who were from Minnesota. And you look at the University of Minnesota, top research one, you know, university, you have the Mayo Clinic there, you have all these Fortune 500 companies concentrated into that one area, extremely, extremely wealthy. And you look within that city itself and you look at the Native community, and they're one of the most impoverished communities just in the city. So that mentality, that brutal legacy of settler colonialism still lives on to this day in a place like Minnesota. And that's why I bristle at the idea of a Minnesota nice.
Well, you and your allies are pushing back and exposing these hypocrisies.
Absolutely. And I just want to give, I think I might have mentioned this earlier, but I just want to give props to the East Phillips neighborhood and the Little Earth United Tribes community for coming together and stopping the city from demolishing a toxic site. It's a huge win. And so that's a bright spot, you know, I think there, and all, you know, all my colleagues in American Indian Studies, all of our previous faculty, all of the alumni who came through that institution, you know, one of the signature community radio stations, McGeezy, was started at the University of Minnesota by UMN students. And one of them was actually one of the first graduates of the American Indian Studies department. So that legacy lives on. And even if they cut our resources, we'll still be doing what we're doing.
And who has inspired and influenced your intellectual development and your activism?
I think the first person who ever articulated it in a way that made sense to me was Vijay Prashad. He taught me that the intellectual can serve many roles. Intellectual isn't necessarily a radical thing, something that has to be shaped. And, you know, but also knowledge that's produced by social movements is legitimate knowledge. And I was doing this work the entire time, but he was the first to say it. But I also turned to more kind of grassroots people. Like, I think Bill Means has had a major impact on my thinking. But he was one of the founders of the International Indian Treaty Council in 1974. Madonna Thunderhawk, of course, I think her kind of just spirit of resistance. And she said something to me that always sticks with me. She was asked at a panel one time during the showing of her documentary, The Warrior Women. She was asked by a student, young student, who said, why did you do everything that you did? Why did you go out and sacrifice the relationships with your own family to be a part of the American Indian movement? She said, because I wanted to be remembered as a good ancestor to future generations, that they would look back at this time period and look at, you know, they inherited a mess, but they knew that there were people out there who were fighting for the future. And so that's what I believe, what makes a good scholar, what makes a good activist, is somebody who's trying to be a good ancestor to future generations.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, David.
You were just listening to Nick Estes, Wounded Knee to Standing Rock, Indigenous Resistance. I talked with him in early May at the University of Denver. Nick Estes is professor in the Department of American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota, and he is co-founder of the Red Nation. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are an independent nonprofit in our 37th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Noam Chomsky, Medea Benjamin, Arundhati Roy, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Nick Estes, Wounded Knee to Standing Rock, Indigenous Resistance, and for Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's classic book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. We go out with Bring Him Out by Aeneas Lacy with John Trudell and Steve Robideau.
Killed on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota.
The government with the FBI, they were waging a contra war against now all of the AIM people and traditionalists. Anytime any grassroots or anytime any group of people start to get popular support, this becomes a threat to the government. And Peltier, then that's when they kind of just put the finishing touches on the momentum that AIM had.
It's up to us, please trust that when the wolves come, they'll bring the guns and the cuffs. But that's okay, cause we're not here to fight. We are the keepers of the peace and the pipe, the defenders of the sacredness of life. And we're here to sing, we're here to bring a new song, a new light to shine upon the men, the women and children of the Red Nation that have endured this genocide. And we're starting right here, Leonard Peltier, and we're not gonna stop until this whole world can hear. Now everybody sing, everybody shout, we're not gonna leave until they bring Leonard on out. Yes, everybody sing, everybody shout, we're not gonna leave until they bring Leonard on out. Yes, everybody sing, everybody shout, we're not gonna leave. Till they bring Leonard out.
I know the way you've been looking at me for half a year. I stand for your failures and discontents. The restlessness that impels you to drop cold calls, cold texts, luring me into a reaction. Baiting me because you didn't know how to get me. Stood my ground and then you turned to anxious rage as impulsive tendencies, harassment, stalking. Half a year, and here's the thing, you can't fuck with me the way you have, because I know I'm a bad bitch, but the question really is, do you?
Sacred, you fresh as our enemies. The disposed of everyone seen demand, and you thought that things were bad.
listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.